This weekend starts right after this.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Understanding mass shooters. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Nearly all shooting massacres are carried out by males who also happen to have feelings of inadequacy. A therapist examines common characteristics.
You've heard about the battle between Elon Musk and Twitter over identifying fake accounts, but what's the definition of one?
Cybercriminals are targeting restaurants. Hear the extortion threats created by a bad rating on Google.
And families continue to raise questions about the value of a college degree.
We have gone to, you can't be anything in this world without a four-year degree. And we are starting to see that that is not true. And the talent shortage plays into that because there aren't enough qualified people graduating from four-year colleges in order to make up the gap.
Career strategist Julie Bauke on whether a college degree is worth your time and money. Well, some stats that may or may not surprise you about mass shooters. 98% are male. Also, they tend to feel inadequate compared to peers, which creates long-term insecurity that makes certain individuals more likely to become mass shooters. More from Lee Richardson, professional counselor and founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Lee, are there usually family issues?
Well, you're absolutely right. With all of them, there's been some emotional trauma. And maybe that means they were bullied in the family, they were, or outside the family, they were sexually abused.
How come these things don't apply to females? Why is it 98% males who are shooters?
Well, you know, it's interesting because doing some reading, and it's the shooting is associated with their masculinity and that being in some way undervalued. And so, and another thing that they all have in common is that they've had access to guns in their life before.
There was a psychologist, a clinical psychologist named Dr. Fabiana Franco, who wrote in Psychology Today saying that the focus on mental illness is misplaced. How come or why?
Well, it's because most of these people haven't been diagnosed with mental illness. I don't think that means that they don't have some mental health issues, but they have not been diagnosed.
Is that likely because we as a society or as a family or as a school have chosen to ignore it?
Well, I think that we have. And I mean, I don't place blame in anywhere. You know me, I'm on a purpose here with creating social change around mental health. But we still stigmatize it. And, you know, we still say, well, you know, they can function. They can come to school on a cognitive level, executive function. They're fine. And because they're cognitively strong, we dismiss the emotional dysfunction. And that's because of the way mental health has been defined.
We're speaking with Lee Richardson, professional counselor, also founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. We're talking about what mass shooters have in common. I feel like, too, every time we read the follow-ups to these profiles for these young men who were accused, it's the same thing. People in the neighborhoods or at school or at work say they're loners. They're antisocial. So why don't we pick up on that earlier and try to get help?
Well, you're right. You know, they are loners. Their self-esteem is very, very low. And they tend to isolate. They don't, and that may be part of the problem. You know, most of them, their masculinity is they think, less than their peers.
But we never seem to take away any lessons from these things.
Well, you know, one lesson that I hope we are taking away, Gordon, is that in every single one of these, they have been able to go and purchase assault rifles.
There's been a mountain of things that have happened long before this, has there not?
There certainly has. I mean, you remember the first school shooting was in 1999? How many years ago is that?
Yeah, I remember. But I'm saying here we are with how many years later?
And we're still having the same problems.
23 years later.
But those, and we haven't done anything that really, I mean, we just made a huge step forward with the passing the new gun law, and I am grateful and thankful for that. But have we restricted the means with that gun law? You got to have an assault rifle to go in and do the type of mass shooting that has been done.
I mean, if they didn't have access to a weapon of some kind, wouldn't they likely use a vehicle?
They could. They could, but all of them have been exposed to the guns before in their life. Or this is what research shows, is that they've all had been exposed to that, and they understand the impact and the power of that. But you make a very good point. We have had people drive cars into crowds, but it's been the consequences have not been as great.
I think I want to say that like a good chunk of my friends are teachers. And when you ask teachers, they can name the small handful of kids in their school that need to be watched. But I don't know that we use them for resources. I don't know that we're allowed to do that, you know, come up with a watch list of some kind, for lack of a better phrase.
Well, you know, you make a good point, and I hope that we can, because I do know that with the recent gun law, that there has been some funds allocated that will go into some training for teachers. And some of them, they know what they're looking for, but do they have a system in place? How do they present that information? And when it is presented, is it welcomed or is it ignored?
Thanks, Lee. Lee Richardson, founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Coming up next, remote jobs that aren't all that remote. Dell's Black Friday in July sale is here. Power productivity with a tech refresh, now with up to 45% off top-rated laptops like the XPS, along with our special deals on business desktops with Intel Core processors. Get big savings on the latest servers, storage, monitors, and more with free shipping and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Upgrade today by calling 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. A lot of positions are listed in job postings as remote, but some come with more ties to the office than suggested. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you're looking for a new job that's remote, you better check the fine print. That word from Lindsay Ellis of the Wall Street Journal, who took a look at the positions that are billed in job postings as remote but come with lots of ties. Lindsay, what did you find?
On sites like LinkedIn, Indeed, even on some companies' job boards, the location for positions is indicated as remote, but if you read the fine print, it might indicate that it's a remote job, but you need to live in a certain commuting distance or region, or it's a remote job with occasional in-person meetings here and there.
Is the problem because remote work might be defined differently at different places?
So that is one problem and one way that this can arise. A company might think a job is remote, but might want you in a certain area, but job applicants might read remote and think, okay, this is a job I can do from anywhere in the whole world. You know, I think the other sort of miscommunication can also just be as companies try and upload their listings to external sites.
And how does that happen? Can you explain that?
Sure. So when a company wants to upload a posting to LinkedIn, you know, it has to indicate whether its job would be remote, hybrid, or on-site, with a small caveat that there is a software that does that automatically for some positions, but that's not all of them on LinkedIn. And so, you know, if it is the type of position that is predominantly remote, but you know, might require someone to come in for some in-person meetings, a hiring manager might tag that one as remote. That's what happened with one company that I looked at. You know, conversely, if an applicant were to filter for remote jobs, they might be really far from that location and still see sort of remote, but it might not be the job for them.
We're speaking with Lindsay Ellis of the Wall Street Journal. Lindsay, some jobs posting saying it's starting as remote, but eventually you're going to have to be back 5 days in the office?
So that sort of reflects some of these evolving plans. I mean, I know a lot of companies are actually using this summer as a time to call people back to the office and start working in person. One job seeker who I talked to said that was actually a key sign that things weren't so nailed down. If he asks, hey, what's your return to office plan? Is this job remote? And they say, we're still working through our plan. That was a flag for him that, you know, more likely than not, he would probably have to be coming into the office, you know, within a couple of months.
So, Lindsay, when you are maybe screening on the phone or you get in touch with the employer, what are some of the things that you should ask?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's an early question that some job seekers are asking, if there's any confusion, just to get that clarification up front. The other thing I would say is that job seekers who have been in this situation are just not taking a remote designation at the top listed as location at face value. You know, you might need to read the listing a couple of times, but there could be a bullet point in there that actually says how often, if at all, you're asked to come into the office.
You mentioned that it might just be a technical, you know, glitch between the posting and LinkedIn and requirements. But what if a company is actually being kind of disingenuous? Is there anything that a potential employee could do about that?
When I talked to a recruiter about this question, you know, that person, James Hornick, told me that it would be probably in a minority of cases that companies say, you know, well, we know job applicants really want this, so we'll post it as remote. But they ultimately just want someone in person, and they have to revise that later on. You know, I think when you're in an application phase, I don't think there's much you can do besides walk away. And I did talk to a few applicants who did walk away when they realized that the position was more in person than they had otherwise thought. But that's sort of, you know, the only recourse I had heard from an applicant's perspective.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Lindsay Ellis. Coming up next, growing questions about the value of a college degree.
Innovation, resilience, agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Glad you could be with us. High schoolers and their parents are increasingly questioning whether a traditional four-year college education is the right financial decision, with rising costs often resulting in crippling student loan debt. In-depth analysis from Julie Bauke, career strategist and founder of The Bauke Group. Julie, what are you hearing?
Well, interestingly, when you look at kind of why college is always seen as the only way, there's a lot of, let's call it, blame to go around. It's, you know, it's anywhere from the parents to the high schools to the colleges themselves. And we have gone to, you can't be anything in this world without a four-year degree. And we are starting to see that that is not true. And the talent shortage plays into that because there aren't enough qualified people graduating from four-year colleges in order to make up the gap. And so employers, from an employer side of the table, they've had to go out there and say, okay, maybe in these particular jobs, we don't need a degree. I mean, I don't know about you. I want my brain surgeon, my architect, my engineer to have degrees. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of other fields in which a two-year degree, a certificate, you know, or even just life experience will, you know, is enough. And so employers from their side of the desk have started relaxing the restrictions around what education you need to have. And we saw this really happening over the last couple years. And so therefore, there are better jobs available for people without a four-year degree. 46% of parents say they would support and wish their young ones would go after something other than a four-year degree, because they're starting to see the financial stranglehold all this debt can have on you. And so, you know, what's happening is this model, this four-year degree model, is starting to crumble because for a lot of reasons. But really, it's just trying to live with all that debt and then seeing you're not having the career that you were quote-unquote promised.
You think we do a lousy job of, say, promoting trade schools, or do trade schools not have the reputation we want them to have? How do you feel about that?
It's multi-part. I think we've developed a real snobbery around around a four-year school. So think about it. So my boys went to a private high school, and there was definitely this sort of, oh, where's your son going? Oh, well, my son's going to Princeton. You know, just sort of this, it reflects on you as a parent where your kid's going to school. And God forbid a kid graduated from that school not going to a four-year degree. It was like, you know, time to clutch the pearls.
Yeah.
So it's the high schools, it's the parents, it's our society in general, but it's also employers who have now started to back away from it, but they've also must have a four-year degree to apply. And so what happened is these great jobs of great companies were unavailable to people who didn't have a four-year degree. And that disproportionately impacts people in rural areas and minorities. And so it has a lot of tentacles here, and there's a lot of blame to go around. But I think the good news is we're starting to come out of it. And that charge is really being led by employers, which I think is where it kind of has to start. Because that's where we're going to end up, right? Working for an employer. They're sort of setting the tone, and they've been forced into it. They don't do anything unless they're forced. They're forced into it because they can't find the people they need. So even Google has created a certificate program that you can take from them on coding and a lot of other technology-related things. And then guess what? They get the first, they watch how you do, and you know, you can land a great job with them after you complete it. And so we need to get back to education alternatives that allow you to do it affordably, and frankly, get in the workforce more quickly and start to build your wealth and your future. You can be so far ahead of the person you sat next to in algebra who's off at a fancy school and is destined for their parents' basement.
Yes, we're speaking with Julie Bauke, career strategist and founder of the Bauke Group. So I spend a lot of time around high school kids. I coach, my daughter just graduated, my son's in college. And I've actually started rephrasing my question to kids, and I say, what are your plans after high school graduation?
Wonderful.
Instead of, where are you going to college?
I've stopped
that completely, because it's not fair.
Yep. It's not fair, because it makes them feel like less than. Try to explain, now they feel like they have to explain to you why they're going to a tech school or a trade school.
Right.
And yeah, so I love that.
Thanks, Julie. Julie Bauke, career strategist and founder of the Bauke Group. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Want to eat healthier, but every supplement you've ever tried seems like the better it is for you, the worse it tastes? Then you have to try AG1 from Athletic Greens. I started taking AG1 because I wanted more energy and better gut health. What I didn't expect, the taste is better than any supplement I've ever had. I drink it, like it says, before anything else when I wake up. I guzzle those 8 to 10 ounces before my coffee and start my day knowing I've already gotten the recommended daily intake of all the good fruits and veggies. There's definitely a mental boost knowing you've started the day off on the right foot. I tackle the day now with more confidence and energy. AG1, by the way, is not only lifestyle friendly, it's cheaper than getting all the different supplements yourself. Try AG1. I love this product. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Gordon. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Gordon to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. athleticgreens.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the extortion threats for restaurants. Plus, the javelin throw returns to high school competitions. And a blackout warning becomes reality on live TV. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, it's not pretty right now between Elon Musk and Twitter. A legal battle between the social media site and the CEO of Tesla is expected to come down to the number of fake and spam accounts on the platform. But how are those accounts defined? Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's a saga that seemingly has no end in sight. Elon Musk versus Twitter. Musk backed out of a $44 billion deal to buy the social media company, claiming he didn't get what he wanted from the company regarding spam and fake accounts. But what exactly is a fake account? Tech analyst Rob Enderle is here now with some insight. Rob, is there a definition in the tech world for what is fake or spam?
Well, yeah. I mean, a fake account is an account that's controlled by a bot. There's no person behind it. And if there's no person there, there's nobody that's going to consume the advertising that they're being hit with. Services like Twitter live on advertising revenue, and showing an ad to a machine that has no ability to buy what the ad is showcasing doesn't provide any value to the advertiser, and thus they don't pay for it. So the advertisers want to advertise to real live people that will buy their goods. They don't want to advertise to bots.
What do we know about how Twitter counts such accounts?
Well, they have an algorithm, but the difficulty is that a really good bot will behave like it's a person. So in some things, a bad bot, which just does repetitive, annoying things, you could probably determine as a bot just through its behavior. But a well-written bot, because it wants people to follow it, will behave like a person. And we've got conversational AI is a thing now, and you can create a very realistic bot that behaves and acts like it's a person. And those are very difficult, if not increasingly impossible, to identify through anything other than trying to contact the individual.
Now, Twitter says that the process they use can't be replicated by outsiders because of the way they do it. Do you concur with that?
Well, so the issue is the way they do the analysis is they look at personal information. That personal information is protected and is protected by law. So they are prevented from sharing that information to a third party unless they're given the ability to do so, the permission to do so. And right now the European government probably isn't going to do that. So in the end, their point is you can do that from inside the company because as long as the data stays inside the company, they're in compliance. But you can't do it from outside the company because that would require them to send that data to you, and they'd immediately be in non-compliance with what is a very strict and a law that has some rather significant company-killing level penalties associated with it.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. Will the onus then be on Musk to prove that Twitter provided him with some false or misleading information of some kind?
Well, in a hostile takeover, the onus is entirely on Musk. The more obvious reason he's backing out of this is it was killing Tesla. People were abandoning their cars. That his purpose for buying Twitter, at least his public purpose for buying Twitter, had nothing to do with the financial performance of the company. He wanted to put people like ex-president Donald Trump back on Twitter. He wanted to get a lot of the Republicans and other people that had been banned from the service back on the service, which didn't play at all well with the people that buy Tesla cars, who for the most part are 90% liberal.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder and principal analyst at The Enderle Group. Coming up next, how cyber criminals are extorting restaurants. Dell's Black Friday in July sale is here. Power productivity with a tech refresh, now with up to 45% off top-rated laptops like the XPS, along with our special deals on business desktops with Intel Core processors. Get big savings on the latest servers, storage, monitors, and more with free shipping and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Upgrade today by calling 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Glad you could be with us. In a new scam targeting restaurants, criminals are leaving negative ratings on restaurants' Google pages as a bargaining chip to extort digital gift cards. Here's this weekend's Jim Chesko.
Leave a negative restaurant review and get a gift card? We bring in New York Times food and culture reporter Christina Morales to explain. So, Christina, this new scam targeting restaurants, how does it work?
What a lot of restaurants told me across the country is that they started to get a blitz of one-star ratings on their Google reviews. And after that happened, a couple of days later, if not immediately after, they would get an email from the alleged scammer saying that they had left those reviews and that they would continue to leave those reviews, at least one review a day, until the restaurant paid them in a $75 Google Play gift card.
Now, this is considered a form of extortion or a cyber crime, is it not?
It is, yes.
Why is it typically Google Play gift cards that are sought by these cyber criminals?
So that's just one of the forms of payment that is just really difficult to trace. So whereas if you were to leave like a check, where you were to write a check with a routing number and such, that kind of thing is traceable back to them. So a Google Play gift card is one of those ways that's really easy for scammers to be able to get this kind of cash, $75. It may not seem like a lot in hindsight, and then that's easy enough for somebody to maybe fall for that. And then in a Google Play gift card, they are able to receive the digital code, and it becomes very difficult to trace back to them.
Of course, whether from legitimate customers or not, restaurants don't want to see negative reviews. Do we know how badly a bunch of negative reviews hurt restaurants' business typically?
Absolutely. And a lot of the restaurants that I spoke with actually carry a number of Michelin stars. And in an area, for instance, like San Francisco, where there is a large number of Michelin-starred restaurants, bad reviews like this, even though they don't have any text or any pictures, these kinds of ratings can actually bring down the overall average rating for a restaurant on Google reviews. So let's say you're a tourist coming into San Francisco and you really want to eat at a Michelin-starred restaurant, and you start to Google these Michelin-starred restaurants, the more likely place that you're going to put your money down, especially if it's on a tasting that's a couple hundred dollars, is on a place with the better average Google review rating. And so this is the kind of thing that has the potential of being able to really affect somebody's business. Some of these places I spoke with had an average of 4.6 and up star ratings, so something that they had essentially worked to, you know, preserve and work to prevent these kinds of situations that would actually even cause a one-star review, like addressing any issues that a customer has in a restaurant. And so all of these average ratings are being brought down. And so that kind of has an effect on a potential customer that may be dining there for the first time.
I saw in your story that some restaurants are actually posting the text from the emailer as a response to the negative reviews. Is that an effective technique or not?
Yeah, so the cybersecurity experts that I spoke with said that this is something that really cannot be prevented, but the best way to kind of circumvent this situation is for a restaurant to spin this and in a public relations type way. So it's essentially to be able to communicate to the customer that this is even happening to them. And so if a customer were to go in and click on the average ratings and see the newest ratings and see the lowest ratings, they're able to see, at least as of yesterday, they were able to see the name of the person that left this one-star review and no pictures or text. And then as the comment goes in, it says, you know, this is a fake review. We've reported this to Google. And then this is the extortion email that we've received. So this kind of thing is very effective in trying to communicate to the customers that this is happening, because this is really, really difficult, if not impossible, to prevent from happening.
That's this weekend's Jim Chesko with Christina Morales, reporter at The New York Times. Coming up next, the competition making a comeback at high schools.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. A quiet movement is soaring across the nation and into states from Florida to Arizona. The javelin throw is making a comeback in high school track and field. Rachel Bachman, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal, noticed the trend. Rachel, what's happening?
Well, what's happening is that different states are actually adding the javelin throw as an event in track and field. So states that either had banned it years ago or never had it in their state track and field meets are including it now.
The decline in javelin in high schools has been so pronounced that the U.S. is not even competitive in the Olympics, right?
That's right. It's been about half a century since a U.S. man or woman won an Olympic medal in the javelin. And it's many countries have won javelin medals since the last time the U.S. did. So it's not terribly competitive. But the numbers in the U.S. are starting to tick up. By my survey, about 22 states now offer the javelin at their high school state championship track meets.
So what's fueling this sudden resurgence in javelin?
I think it's a combination of things. One, it's longtime coaches who, you know, miss the event and want to help bring it back. They talk about how it's a very versatile event. There's, you know, kids of all sizes and shapes can excel at it, and they think that's a great opportunity to add to their meets. And I think there's some perspective about injury rates. You know, there certainly have been some injuries in the javelin, but the rate of injuries for instance, track and field as a whole is far lower than the injury rate in, for instance, cheerleading or football. So I think there's a growing perspective about, hey, if we're careful about this, we think we can do this very safely.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. It's almost a kind of thing where it looks more dangerous than it is. But as you mentioned, not as dangerous as football, cheerleading, lacrosse, or a sport like that.
Yeah, it's all a matter of perspective. And the people I spoke with who've added it take this responsibility very seriously. They have very elaborate measures to make sure nobody's in the path of the javelin when there's a practice or a meet going on. They want this to continue. They want us to keep growing. And so they're taking a lot of responsibility. And they want the teenagers doing this to take responsibility too.
As a javelin coach that you quoted in your story says, all it takes is one incident to shut the whole thing down.
That's true. And there certainly have been a small number of very high profile incidents that people remember because they tend to be very gruesome. So that certainly is top of people's minds when they think about this. But, you know, there often are injuries, you know, serious injuries, for instance, in football that we don't even hear about, or cheerleading for that matter, because they're more common. It's just that javelin injuries tend to be very memorable and tend to be highlighted in the media. So that's why they've kind of lingered in memory.
In any cases, the parents of javelin throwers are going to be a little bit nervous, I guess.
You know, I think they are. It depends on the parents, of course. If they're really nervous, they're not going to let their kids do it. But you know, I talked to a girl who just finished seventh grade and was competing for her high school team, and she really loved the event. She said it's a nice change of pace from a team sport, and she likes to, you know, measure her own personal improvement, and she's excited to come back next year.
Thanks, Rachel. Rachel Bachman, sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, a meteorologist warns of blackouts and then gets one on air. How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save. We'll finish with this. A TV meteorologist in Texas continued discussing scorching temperatures even after a power outage left him in the dark during a forecast. Travis Herzog, a meteorologist for KTRK-TV in Houston, was talking about the chance of blackouts in Texas due to a heat wave when a blackout happened in the studio a couple of days ago.
You have this kind of heat over major populations. You get a big draw on that electric demand. And it looks like we may have just switched over to generator power. Our lights just went out.
KTRK-TV says the lights went dark a second time during another broadcast by the station. One of the station's engineers told Mr. Herzog that the studio lights initially went out because they weren't on a dedicated backup power source. For the past week, as you probably know, Texans have been dealing with temperatures around or over 100 degrees in places like Houston, Austin, and Waco. The Electricity Reliability Council of Texas has asked people in the state to voluntarily conserve electricity to avoid straining the system. The news station transitioned to generator power before returning to the grid 2 hours later. Mr. Herzog joked on Twitter that maybe it's just his electrifying personality. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.